He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, Paul,
hey.
Guess who is going to join us today for All of the Above?
I've heard a rumor, but I just can't believe it.
And
you could be this lucky.
Is a glorious actress.
Oh, yeah.
Known for a great many things we'll talk about. And a new book.
Yeah.
About her life, a book of essays about her life.
Yeah.
And from what I have read about the book, because I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, fabulous. The life has been a difficult, harrowing, hilarious. Well, I'm trying to remember the adjectives that I've loved reading about the book.
The reviews are great.
Glorious.
And the book is great.
Glorious. And she's entering now.
Oh, and here she is.
Oh, hi.
Wow, we didn't even see you coming
in.
And
we'll withhold her name for a while.
Wow, yes.
Hi, Christine. Christine Lottie has joined us, folks.
Hi, Norman. So nice to be here.
It's glorious to have you here. And I love, she walked in and brought a copy of the book, which I had not seen. And I love the title, True Stories from an Unreliable Witness. But what I didn't know was this photograph, which, I mean, she could take tens of thousands of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And one would, and might not have the right one. And this is absolutely the right one for this book, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely, it totally is. How did you, when you're looking at the context sheet, because I'm sure you had the face on, looking, you know, like right at the camera, looking writerly or looking, how did you choose? Because it is a great shot.
This shot really, as Norman said, really speaks about what the book is, which is, oh, my God, I'm spilling my beans. Have I spilled too many beans? What have I done?
But when you
too many beans.
When you put it together so perfectly, you can use a word like unreliable, and it means reliable.
That's right. Thank you for understanding that, Norman. Yes, because I had some friends say, well, wait, now we don't want to think that you're an unreliable narrator. And I said, no, hopefully they're going to be smart enough to know that it's tongue-in-cheek and that I mean, in fact, that I am reliable because I'm trying to be as honest and authentic as I can be.
And knowledge of the imperfection of memory.
That's right.
Which you write about, where that comes from.
Yes.
Right? Where you came up with that unreliable
eyewitness.
Tell us about that with your mom and dad in the car.
Oh, yeah. So,
I love that story.
Yeah, so I recounted this really traumatic story from my childhood to my brother and sister. I reminded them of this story because they were there.
Yeah.
A time when my dad kicked our mom out of the car, out of the station wagon, six kids in a station wagon. We're in a trip to see the Chicago Science Museum. He kicked her out of the car for smoking a cigarette. And she went out, got out of the car. It was snowing. And I was sitting in the way, way back. And I just remember seeing my mom just get smaller and smaller and smaller as my dad drove away. And I thought, I'm never going to see my mom again.
Mm-hmm. How old were you?
Eight.
Oh,
eight.
Yeah.
And I was traumatized. And I recounted this to my brother and sister. And they said, what? That didn't happen. And I said, but you were in the car.
Yeah.
You, of course it happened. They said, we don't really remember. Well, maybe something weird happened, but I think, no, we don't remember that.
Are they younger?
One older and one younger.
So one old. So that's a pretty good survey.
Yeah.
You got one older, one younger.
They didn't remember.
Right.
And to me, it was one of the very big emotional memories.
Oh, yes. You don't make that up.
No, you don't make that up. No. I remember every specific detail about it.
Right.
So that's how it just emblazoned into my memory.
What was she wearing? Because I saw a woman on the road once.
in Chicago on a snowy day, smoking the last butt of
a
cigarette.
Yes, yes, all of the above.
But there's another era where Dad kicks Mom out of the car like a child or
That's right. There were several times in my childhood where I witnessed my mom being treated as if she was a child.
Mm.
If she misbehaved, she had her credit cards taken away.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was that last, that, well, I think Trump is still trying to bring us back to the caveman days. But yeah. The last hurrah of the 50s patriarchy where, the dad was the boss and the mom was a little bit of a second-class citizen and kind of made into a child in that way.
Hmm. Did that come into focus for you? Where did that wisdom come from? Where did that ability to see that for what it is? When did that come in? And how do you suppose you had that ability to see it?
When did I get?
Because you're a lifelong feminist. This is not new for you.
No,
this has been going on since you were very young.
But I keep getting woke. And when my first awakening was in college in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the University of Michigan, when the second wave of feminism happened. I'd never heard of such a thing. I thought that was just the way it was. I thought women just weren't as valued.
Mm. Well, growing up in a home where your father could punish your mother that way.
Yes, exactly.
I understand.
Yeah.
Before we go any further, would you reel some of the titles you've been connected to so that those people who are listening who may not know the name Lottie would know the face if they were seeing it, but they're not.
Sure. Yes. I guess some of the films I'm best known for are Running on Empty, the Sidney Lumet movie, Housekeeping, the Bill Forsyth movie based on the Marilyn Robinson novel.
And Justice for All.
Yeah.
So great in that.
Thank you. And Swing Shift, Jonathan Demme directed.
Oh, how I love Jonathan Demme.
I know.
Did you not love him when you were working with him?
Loved him.
You can't overstate the word Jonathan, because he represented the sweetest, purest of humanity.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
He did. He was, every person on the set was as valuable and important as anybody else. There was no hierarchy of value. It was just love coming out of this man. Wow. I know he loved you, Norman, a lot.
Yes, and I loved him. My first job in the show business was working for United Artists, but when I came in to this office before, I was a bunch of kids sitting there, because Jonathan Demme is considerably younger than me, sitting at desks. There was a Kathy Berlin. You ever run into Kathy Berlin? She does publicity in New York.
Yes, yeah.
Jonathan Demme and Kathy Berlin were sitting side by side. I came to know and love both of them. Jonathan, very close for all of the rest of his life. Anyway, shakes his head and gets rid of that thought, and we're off.
Okay. And moving on.
But you met him as a kid, Demme?
Well,
he was a kid.
Yes, he was. He was in his mid-20s.
Yeah.
And I was working at United Artists. This was before he directed anything.
Right. What did he do? I can't remember what happened.
He was doing press.
He passed away a year ago?
A year and a half, maybe.
A year and a half. Yeah, I think cancer or something.
I was touring with the book, and I was in some place in New York State. I can't remember where.
Mm-hmm.
And finished a meeting in time to rush to a movie, and in the lobby there was Jonathan. And I knew he had been sick, and I had been in touch with him, but I hadn't seen him. Anyway.
Yeah, he looked pretty sick. I saw him towards the end, too. It was not good.
Well, knowing you a bit, knowing him a lot better, but knowing you a bit, you had to fall in love with each other.
I think it was mutual. I think we had it was pretty strong. Yeah. I always wanted him to be directing more films, and I don't know why. I think he just, he really was picky about what he wanted to do.
Yes.
And he did a lot of documentaries and music documentaries.
Really cool stuff.
Yeah. Talking Heads.
Yeah, I love that film. Stop Making Sense.
Stop Making Sense. Yeah.
And then you also done lots of television.
Oh, yes, I have. Yes.
And you directed.
Yes.
And you made a short.
Which one did you direct?
I directed a short film that won.
Won an Academy Award.
Thank you.
Is that all? Just
that's
an
all?
Academy Award?
Just that, yeah. Yeah.
It's just an Academy Award.
It was pretty amazing, and especially because I was I went with Tommy Schlamme, who's my husband, who's very well-known director.
Yeah.
And all these friends who came up to him after I won the Oscar for my first time out of the gate directing, and they came up to him and said, "Oh, aren't you proud of Christine? And isn't that great?" And Tommy said, And then a really close friend came up to him and said, "Aren't you pissed?" And he said, "Yes. This is not fair."
Throw you out of the car.
What was the title of the film?
Lieberman in Love.
Oh, Lieberman in Love. I don't remember seeing it, but I remember that title well.
Yeah, Danny Aiello, Nancy Travis, and myself. I started my own first directorial effort. And then I directed a feature film called My First Mister with Albert Brooks and Lily Sobieski.
That's a cast.
Wow. That was fun. Yeah. But yeah, television, Chicago Hope, Jack and Bobby, Law and Order, SVU.
You want to say SUV?
You
every
do,
time,
you
don't
do.
You?
Yeah.
Are there two personalities any more different than Albert Brooks and Jonathan Demme? Personalities.
No, you're right. They're the polar opposite.
Polar opposite of each other.
Yeah,
I love them.
Love them both.
Love them both. Yes, a lot.
How would you say that?
Well, Jonathan was all love, and it didn't matter to him, to everybody.
Yes.
And Albert is extremely alone.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to put it, Norman. He doesn't suffer fools easily. He doesn't, if you're not engaging to him, he'll just check out.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you could be engaging the third time you saw him.
Yeah.
And
true.
He didn't find you engaging the first two.
It's true.
Now, very famously, then we'll get it out of the way, because I just loved the moment, and I know everybody talks about it, at the Golden Globes when you were in the bathroom when your name was called.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
That was one of the great moments, because it was just so real. And then when you said, "I was flushing," and somebody said, "You won," and you thought they were kidding.
I thought it was some dirty, horrible joke. Mean joke.
What year was it?
What year was it? It was for Chicago Hope.
Yeah, it was Chicago Hope.
I don't even know. But it was a long time ago. But they had switched the order in the program, so I thought I had plenty of time. But I didn't see the little asterisk that says order subject to change. So I went to the restroom with my girlfriend and just, was talking. And I thought, I had a funny feeling. I thought, I should go back. I shouldn't be hanging out in the restroom. And on my way in, this lady came out of the ballroom. She said, "Oh, you just won."
Said, that's so great.
I said, "That's really not funny. I did not. My category." She said, "Well, I'm sorry, but you did. You just won." And Robin Williams, of course, jumped up on the stage famously and started vamping.
Oh, yes.
And then I grabbed his dinner napkin and wiped my hands and said, "I'm sorry, Mom. I was in the bathroom. It's the first thing that came to my mind."
Great improv work, by the way. That was really, funny. You and Robin Williams.
Yeah. I have to say, it was one of my most inspired comedic moments. I will just say that I am proud of that grabbing of the towel.
Was your mom alive?
No, she wasn't.
But she was listening.
She was listening. But it was interesting that was the first thing that came to my mind, is that I had to somehow apologize to my mom about it.
That's so great.
We don't change all that.
No, we don't.
So early on, you go to New York. You started your acting career in New York, correct?
Yes.
And then another thing that I've heard you talk about, I've read about, is the casting couch experience that you had with the commercial director.
Right.
And I want you to tell us about that, but then also the effect of that. In odd way, it seems to have empowered you. You seem to have a sense, not on. And you know what? MF, watch me.
Yeah. In fact, every time I've had a Me Too moment, and there have been many, none that were horrible. They're all horrible. They all take away your humanity, any kind of sexual harassment. But they've always made me stronger in a way, because I've become more determined to prove them wrong. Now, this casting director said, "You can have these two national commercials. And all you got to do is sleep with the directors. But he said it.
And he was doing this for someone else.
That's right. He was pimping.
He was the casting guy doing it for the director.
That's for two different directors. Right. I had to sleep with both of them.
Now that, oh. Can we just pause there for a second? Because I think that is, that's low life. You can't get much lower. You can't get lower than that.
I think you're right.
He's harassing
for somebody
on behalf of somebody else.
Yes, on behalf of these two directors. And when he said it, it was that matter-of-factly. And when he saw my horrified face, because I had walked in there as a brand new feminist. I was in my mid-20s, and I had felt like I have value as a person. I'm not just a girl, which is second class. I am a fully valued, empowered human being with talent, with ambition, with intellect, with accomplishment. And then by saying this, he reduced me to a sex object and he took away my humanity. And he went on to say that not only did I have to sleep with these directors, but I was a fool to say no, because the only way I would make it was to sleep my way to the top. Mm-hmm. He said it was just a reality. It's what you have to do. And you may as well face reality. Here are the five very famous, well-known actresses who, from his point of view, had slept their way to the top. That's how you do it. And
he reeled off five names?
He did.
Oh, who were they?
I'm not going to tell you.
And there's one of them still around.
Yeah, but really famous actresses. And he doesn't, how does he know? He's a commercial casting director. How does he know, right? Anyway, I burst out crying and I was devastated and I ended up walking home 75 blocks to my home in the West Village. But during that walk, I became a feminist, not just in my head. It dropped bone marrow deep, never to leave my body. My feminism. And I realized this was my life jacket. My feminism was going to be my life jacket to help me navigate through a world that did not like or respect women that much.
Great image.
So that was my one of my big click moments. Of course,
a life jacket that helped me navigate life.
A world that didn't respect women.
A world that didn't respect. Oh my God, that's good.
It really helped me a lot. But of course, because of if you grow up a female in this culture, you're going to internalize misogyny. You can't help it. So about 2 hours after I got home, after this woke, big awakening feminist click moment, a boy calls up and says, do you want to come to this premiere of a movie? And I really had a crush on him, and I really loved the movie, and I wanted to go to a premiere, but I said no. And I made up some excuse, but the reason was I felt I had gained 5 pounds.
Oh, there you go. So it comes and goes.
That's right. There's
an ebb and flow with that. And is that because it's so deeply rooted?
Yes, yes. I mean, women, I give my power away to men still.
Yeah.
Depending on the man, I'll feel insecure. So it's just as limiting as the feminine gender definition has been, which is what my mom's generation, which is you can be a housewife, you can be a mom, a nurse, maybe a teacher, but that's it. Mm. Just as limiting as that definition was, I looked at my dad and I saw how limited he was. He wasn't able to have really close relationships with his children because being a father was not a real hands-on father was not in his job description, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't able to cry. He wasn't able to have to really express his feelings.
Yeah.
He's like a half of a human being, that kind of rigid, gender, male, toxic, sort of masculine.
Which the culture applauds.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you grow up a female looking at my mom and my girlfriend's moms, you can't help but internalize some kind of inferiority or some kind of second classness.
Yeah.
So my journey as a feminist, which is what my book's about, one of the things, is how my feminism has been a lifelong process, that I keep getting on the feminist wagon and falling off and getting back on. And every time a man discouraged me, like, you're not going to make it unless you blank. I've had several men that have done that. Mm. You're not going to make it unless you become a prostitute, basically. it made me stronger. It made me determined, more determined to prove them wrong. And I'd climb back up on the feminist wagon. And I'm pretty solidly up there now, I think. Now in my 60s, I feel pretty secure.
Yeah, it's too bad you didn't succeed in show business, though, right?
I mean, the woman who just called herself, announced herself to be in her 60s.
Yes.
Looks far more like her 40s or late 30s.
Well, wow. I'll take that.
This is very true.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
If there is anybody listening that can get here right away, you see for yourself.
Come by. Come on by and visit. So I wanted to ask you about this. This is always – I wonder about this. And you can maybe help us as Norman and I, as males, doing our best. Because we also grew up in that world.
Yes. And you've internalized that shit.
That shit. No, you said shit.
Okay.
And so for instance, chivalry, basic chivalry. I know this is feminism 101, but chivalry, mm-hmm. where does that fit in? The old school chivalry of mm-hmm. opening doors and all of that mm-hmm. stuff. I mean –
okay, here's my feeling on it.
What is your...
Whoever gets to the door first opens it. That's how I feel.
I love opening the door.
I do, too.
I really like it.
I like it. It's very sweet. I love it. I like any kind of kindness. Both ways.
I do. I like that, too. So yeah. I guess there's a bit of that that as woke and, mm-hmm. and woking as I want to be, and we all want to be, I suppose there's a bit of that I don't want to let go of.
Yeah.
And to hear from your perspective, no, whoever gets there first. But I want to do
then
that.
Get there first.
Then get there first.
Yeah, get there first.
Get there first. That's the answer.
That's the answer.
That's great. Now, and the other place, here's where I got woke, writing. Because I'll be doing some, I'll write some, you know, scripts and things like this. And I realized, and I'd love to hear your take on this, Norm, because you've always written women so strongly, that I realized myself, I was watching an interview with somebody, you know, an actress talking about, and I'd heard it a million times, about roles for women, develop characters, mm-hmm. real characters, real multidimensional characters. And all of a sudden, I just had a moment where I go, oh, my God, I don't do that in my own writing because I'm a dude, I'm a male, grew up in this world, and I need to think about that. I mean, I need to learn to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your take on that, because I know there's a lack of roles for women, right?
Yes.
You talk about, and where there are, there's a lack of dimension to them.
Yes.
But maybe it's that people need to really hear that message.
I think it's the next chapter, inevitable chapter of Time's Up, the Time's Up movement, which is Time's Up on putting... on ageism for women, on putting women past, I don't know, 40, 50 out to pasture and assuming they're just going to go become invisible. I got into my early 60s and I got hit with a tsunami of ageism that put me into a kind of funk. I was very despairing because I'd been lucky enough to get great roles. Maybe I didn't work as often as I wanted to, but through my 40s and 50s, and I turned 60 and it all dried up and I was freaking out because I thought, wait, I'm at the top of my game. I'm at my creative prime. I have so much more experience now to bring to my art, and now there's no good parts. So I was despairing and complaining, and my feminist daughter, Emma, who Norman knows, said, so quit complaining, Mom, and don't sit around waiting for some man to hire you. Go create your own stuff. And she said, you have a lot of good stories to tell. Why don't you start writing them? And I said... well, that sounds great, honey, but I'm not a writer. So she said, so go learn how to write, bitch. She didn't really say bitch, but it felt like it.
But it's better that way. Yeah. You are a writer. She was right.
So I learned how to write, and I developed them as monologues at first because I thought, well, maybe I'll write my own one-woman show.
Oh, cool.
Right?
Yeah.
And I don't have to be dependent because as an actor, we're so dependent on others to hire us.
Oh.
Right? So it's just can make you crazy. So I thought, well, all right, I'm going to start producing, developing, writing my own stuff. So I developed these stories as maybe a one-woman show and then performed them all over New York, Joe's Pub in L.A. at the Wallace Sorting Room.
And was that scary? Because that ain't somebody else's script and someone else's life. This is your life and your words, right?
So scary.
Yeah.
So vulnerable making. Because the first time I did it was a little... Cornelia Street Cafe in the West Village.
I love that place.
In the basement.
I love it, yeah.
Little tiny, 50 people. It's a little cabaret. I performed my first, I guess I did three or four stories. And it was terrifying because...
And they were real stories out of your life.
These stories that developed eventually into the book after 3 years. So, yeah, I was saying my own words. I couldn't hide behind a character. It was me.
Yeah.
My stories. I've always told other people's stories. So it was terrifying.
Christine.
Yes.
What's one of your short pieces? Because you won't want to tell a long one. So I'm asking for a short one.
A short one? In the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh.
You're on.
I'm suddenly...
It's 8 p.m. The curtain's going up. Ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I have a lot of comedic ones in there.
Yes.
Very funny. To me, they're funny. The time when I was in the bathroom at the Golden Globe. But I try to do the bigger picture of that. My whole life, I tried to be a perfect human being, a perfect feminist, a perfect woman, a perfect everything. And having that happened to me around a Golden Globe really helped me find a sense of humor, helped me to really embrace that sense of humor about awards, about myself, about imperfection. Yeah. So a lot of the stories are about my imperfections and trying to find a way of embracing them. So a short story, I'm trying to think. Okay, here's one. So I went to the storage unit in Culver City, and I was with my husband. We're going to... You know, those storage units, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we're opening the thing, our big garage door, and it's this labyrinth, this endless labyrinth of these storage units, and we're all alone in the basement. This woman comes up to us, and she says, can I hang out with you guys? Because there's this really creepy guy following me around, and he's stalking me, and I'm really scared.
And this is a man or a woman?
This is a woman who approached us. So I said, yeah, of course, and I'm feeling very protective, and I'll walk you over to your unit, and I can help you I'll stand guard while you get your stuff out. Of course, Tommy's two rows over, so I'm feeling very, very heroic. So she's getting her stuff out, and this huge man lumbers by, and he looks like Frankenstein. He's huge and weird and scary, and he's just walking by, and I'm starting to panic, and the woman is obviously really scared of this guy because he's been kind of stalking her, she thinks. So anyway, long story short, I end up walking her to the elevator and putting her on, and she tells me this brief anecdote about she went to McDonald's the other day with her mother, and this guy walked by her, and
different guy,
but had just she just walked by him and didn't say anything. And then on her way out, he walked by her again and slugged her in the back of the head, sent her glasses flying, and said, "Now you know who I am, bitch," because he had felt ignored by her. So she had just had a violent thing happen to her, so she was hyper scared about this stalker in this storage room. All right, so then long story short, I put her in the elevator, I walk back, and I'm terrified because he's going to jump out at me at any moment. And I have all these memories of violence to me that has been inflicted on me, and I think about my brother, how he used to beat me up. And I think about the times I've been stalked on the streets in New York, and all those memories, they're like, they come to the surface, you know, the violence inflicted on us stays in us as women. And so all these things have come to the surface, and I'm really panicking about this guy. And then we hear him, Tommy and I, we hear him whimpering and crying over a couple rows over. And then we see a guy from the storage unit come up and help him and escort him into the bathroom. So this was a mentally challenged, adult that was looking for a bathroom. And I felt so bad that I had demonized him, and I was so afraid of him. And at the end of the story is called Monster. At the end of the story, I say, I'd like to think that next time I go to the Culver City storage unit, I could ask him if he needs help, maybe even ask him his name. Maybe next time I won't be such a monster.
Oh,
that's good. That's really good.
It's one of the, it's one of the, unfortunately, the repercussions of male aggression is that women don't trust and can't be empathetic in a situation where a guy is just requiring help.
Yeah. Yeah, what an honest story, though, to share that. It's,
That's a great
looking
story.
For that.
Yeah, it's another side of it, finding that empathy.
Yeah, for those of you who may just have happened on us, that was Christine Lottie telling a story.
Yeah, thank you for that. God, I wish I'd seen your show. Will you do it again? Will you be doing it again?
Yeah, I'm looking to adapt now the book into a proper play, like a one-woman real journey of a play.
And then the film.
And then the film, and then the TV series, yeah.
Oh, my God, I am so perfect for role with Tommy Shalhoub.
I can see it.
Yes, yes. Sir. Hey, speaking of acting, I heard you say a great thing in an interview, I read it somewhere, where you were just talking about things that you've said no to roles because you were uncomfortable with some aspect of it, mm-hmm. as a woman. And you said a great thing that I just really learned a lesson from, even just an acting lesson. Great choice. The director wanted you to wear it. You said, no, I'm not going to wear a tank top. I'm on my way to break up with this guy. Why would I wear a tank top? And I just went, oh, my God, right, of course. You wore a man's shirt or something.
I wore a man's vintage shirt, yeah. And the director thought I was crazy.
And here's a director who should be thinking this way, thinking about character, thinking mm-hmm. about the situation, but he was thinking with his dude brain.
Yes, and he probably was
the dude brain with his studio brain.
With
his
studio brain, yeah. And that's why his eyes rolled up to the top of his head when I said, oh, I would never wear a tank top in this scene.
Oh, I didn't know that. He rolled, oh, really? Like, well, oh, please.
A little bit. He was like, really? Why not? He couldn't understand it. But I was very, you know, in those days, I refused to ever do any nudity because the last thing I wanted was to be treated like a sex object, right?
Right.
That was against everything as a second wave feminist that
but
we wanted.
Let me ask a basic question, yeah. about our culture.
Yes.
Doesn't our culture serve up women or wish to, or that is, I mean, women resist it and so it doesn't happen all the time, but they serve up women as sex objects.
Yes, completely. And still today, I mean, I think younger women are a little more empowered. And if you're going to treat her like a sex object, that's your problem, because they can celebrate their sexuality in ways that I think my generation couldn't.
And be nude and be sexual.
Yes.
And all that.
It's the pro-sex feminists, young millennial feminists. I think that's beautiful, oh, that good. They can celebrate that and not have to deny any part of themselves. But yeah, if you're not vigilant and mindful, you can be served up as an object so mm-hmm. easily. So I think even...
Well, fashion tends to do that.
Yes. Fashion does that. But I think it's... Yeah, I was just so sensitive about not ever wanting to... I wanted respect. That's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to look sexy. I didn't want to do sexy scenes. I didn't want to... You know, and unfortunately, it was a kind of denial of a big part of myself. Mm. So...
That's the danger, right? That's where to
yeah, I think
to
so.
Deny that part, because we're all sexual.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't deny it in my private life. It just in my career, I just was very careful.
Let's hear about that.
Yeah. The private
yeah,
life.
Your private life.
Okay,
one.
Sure. Yeah. So anyway, sexually, what I like. No. Where are we going?
Where are we going? That's an interesting thing, though. The evolution, it sounds like, of feminism. Because what your generation and yes. what you would not, could not, there wasn't a framework for it to be. And you hadn't fully taken that thing to say, no, I'm sexual. This is it.
And if you
as you believe they're doing now.
I do. I think that's an evolution. That it's a positive evolution.
Yeah.
I do. And I don't think every woman did that, certainly. But there were a lot of women in my generation who the only way we thought to be taken seriously as artists, as actors, was to get respect. And the last thing we wanted to do was to play two-dimensional sex objects. Mm. You know, we wanted to be the ones running around having the adventures. We didn't want to be the ones sitting at home in a negligee waiting for their guy to come home to have sex.
Right.
We wanted to be out there. So it has evolved, and I think in a positive way.
Yeah, so the Me Too movement and all this stuff, it's just amazing, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
And for you to see this happening, having been at it for a while.
It's so thrilling.
Yeah.
It's so unbelievably thrilling that women are speaking up and being believed, but feeling empowered. And I think a lot of it is, I think that these young women are so empowered. And part of it is because they had feminist mothers, right? Mm. My generation, we didn't have feminist mothers.
Right.
A few of us did, but mm-hmm. for the large barn. We didn't. So I think it's every generation of women, it's going to be better and better for them.
And you've had the great honor as a feminist of being called a feminazi by Rush Limbaugh himself.
But he coined it, didn't he?
Yeah. He coined it. Yeah. He coined it.
But you actually were called that by him.
I was so
honored. It's like Norman being on Nixon's enemies list. You guys have both gotten great honors.
They are alike, aren't they?
Weren't you honored, Norman, when he put you on the enemy list?
Oh, yes. I felt it even then.
You did on the day.
But then, years later, I think he was gone. He was certainly out of the scene when they found the recordings in the Oval Office. And one of those recordings had him talking about an episode of All in the Family where Mike told Archie that his good friend, the football player, was gay. And Archie runs into him at a bar and they are arm wrestling. And Archie haltingly talks about his crazy kid married to his daughter who thinks you could, and he's choking on it, that you could be gay. And the guy just stares at him, the clenched hands in front of him, just stares at him. Archie, did you ever hear me talk about a woman? Well, no, but...
that was in the tapes?
No, yes. And Nixon,
that's the show. That's the episode.
And then Nixon commented on it in the White House tapes.
So he was talking about this show that made a fool of a good man. And dealing with homosexuality,
right,
which brought down Greece. He says.
Does he say, like, I don't think the son of all is a fag or something like that? Did he refer to somebody?
Yeah. Oh, my God, what an honor that he quoted your episode.
And you were also one of the most dangerous people in the United States, right? That was the moral majority, I think.
That was Jerry Falwell, the number one enemy of the American family in our generation.
Right here. I'm sitting across from him.
Don't you? You're in danger, Christine. He's a dangerous man.
Oh, God. I feel like, you're such a national treasure, Norman.
Oh, please.
No,
we're
I
all
mean
national
it.
Treasures.
No, but you are. You are. You changed my life. I mean, the women that you had on your shows and the embracing of really taking on racism and sexism and in such an honest, funny, human way. I just it changed the landscape of our country.
I love hearing. Yes. It's funny how you can love hearing something and at the same time
not like it.
No, I have to face myself. I do like it.
You have that thing called humility.
But I guess, enough. Mm-hmm.
Enough. Okay, I won't say it humility. Again. I had to say it at least once. I mean, sitting across Norman Lear.
Yeah. But you said you defined feminism. I read somewhere, and it was very simple.
Yes.
Tell us what that, very, very simple. It's simply...
It's right out of the dictionary, just somebody who believes in equal rights, that men and women should have equal rights, period.
It's 100% of your behavior. I mean, that's the essence that flows from you.
Yes.
So what is that fear? What's the what is that fear? And obviously, the sweeping thing, the male power structure, I get all that. It goes back to forever. So this is a huge seismic change.
It goes back to I wouldn't wear a tank top for that scene.
Right.
That's right.
But what are men afraid of?
What are men afraid of? Okay, well, do we have about 5 hours we can talk? Because this is a big question. I think that white men of privilege, they are of the most privileged place, right? What Trump and a lot of his supporters are feeling, these uppity women are taking our jobs. These uppity women are taking our power. These immigrants, these people of color are all, they're threatening our position threatening the patriarchy.
Yeah.
Our superiority.
Which is a fixed structure.
According to them, it is the way it is.
Yeah.
It's fixed. It is how they are born into it.
And the way God wants it.
God, yes. God, our ultimate patriarch.
Yeah.
Right. Who is a white man, according to them.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I think they're afraid of that. I think that they And I just wish that more men would understand that feminism is so liberating to men. Like I was saying about my dad, how limited he was as a non-feminist, as a chauvinist, that he couldn't be a full human being. He couldn't express his feelings, as I said. He couldn't be a father. He couldn't be all the things that embracing that feminine side of himself that people like you guys and Jonathan Demme and my husband and so many men have realized, oh, there's a lot of goodies in being a feminist.
Yeah, absolutely. But isn't there an economic sense to it that you could just say that if there are more women, there will be more things created. There will be – it just widens the whole platform of things, I would think. No?
I would think, yeah.
It's not like there's 10 jobs in the world and now women want 5-7 of them.
Right.
No, it will expand out. Same with immigrants. Same with but it's interesting. It's great to hear you talk about this in the way that you do because we're all evolving. You know, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, which was not the most – forward place in the 70s growing up, whether it was race, whether it was, you know, religious, whether it was gender issues, all of this stuff. I got out into the world and it was like, wow, it's a big, colorful world with all different kind of flavors. And it's right there in your face. And so what do you do with that? You know, so to keep listening, to keep the conversation going. And I think, and this is what I like about the book, where you you talk about those flaws like that story you told.
Yes.
That's a deep, wonderful thing to share. And Norman, you do this when we talk about race stuff or things of gender. Admit, you talk about being from another generation.
Right.
We need to evolve. We need to have conversations
like
this. And I like the way that you put this stuff.
Well, as honestly as I can, I mean, there are moments then that I have racist thoughts. Okay.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
And I am not a racist.
Yeah.
I am an intersectional feminist, which means my daughter taught me this, which is the focus is on race. It has to be.
Mm.
There's no such thing as white feminism because, as Gloria Steinem says, feminism is all-inclusive or it's not anything. Right. But there are – the focus now is intersectional, which is we must do that. We must listen. We must learn from black women who have – so many more obstacles than white women of privilege, right? So it's just a shift. But so if I have a racist thought, like I'm not going to cross the street in New York because there's two black guys on the corner, but I might if it's two white guys.
Yeah.
If I have that thought, I've got to be mindful of it. I'm not going to act on it. I'm not going to be scared or you know, maybe even avoid going into the store next to them. But I just should be mindful of it and just watch that. What is that? That is an internalized old, it's like the monster story, right?
Yeah.
Internalized old habitual something that I just need to be honest about and not act on it ever.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
be mindful of
it. And recognize that it comes with your generation.
That's right.
I'm reminded of my oldest daughter. I have five of those people, young women.
You have five daughters.
I have five daughters. And the oldest one, when she was a little girl, was raving about a teacher, just raving her art teacher. And one evening, it was parents' night or something, we were at the school, and I met the teacher for the first time, and she was black. And I couldn't get over that my daughter had not told me the teacher she loved was black.
Mm-hmm.
And realized, of course, almost at the same moment, that at first I was hard on myself. Then I'm a product of my generation.
That's
I can't help it.
Yeah.
That's the way it was. That's the way we think.
Right.
I don't approve of it. I don't in any way, I'm not in any way proud of it, but it was part of my humanity I couldn't not deal with it that way.
That's right. And she didn't even see a difference of color.
No.
She's colorblind.
Or she saw it, of course, and accepted it as just
what it was.
What it was. Exactly. Yeah. And same with sexism. So I have sexism. There's certain times, about when women chose to stay at home at first, I was very judgmental of that. I thought, wait, you've got feminism now and you're choosing to be a stay-at-home mom. And I would be judgmental of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't anymore because I find that there's finally more respect for women that choose that, who choose not to have a career or they leave their careers to make that decision. So that was sexist of me to be judgmental of a woman's choice. That's
right.
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 And same with Kim Kardashian. Can we just talk about her? So I was judgmental of her. I thought, wait a second. She's calling herself a feminist.
Right.
Didn't quite buy. I didn't see it. And then I realized, wait, who am I to grade anybody else's feminism?
Yeah.
She's entrepreneurial. She's a grillionaire. She's got a grillion followers. And she's, you know, she's an artist in her
But Devil's way. Advocate would say yes. She built that empire on a sex tape. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So.
Well, that's what I would say.
Yeah. So she so built what? An empire.
Yeah, but she had a whole culture helping her do that. There's, you know, there was a culture ready for
no,
it.
No, I judge it not. I'm wondering what would be like the feminist take on that.
I think she's a feminist.
Yeah.
I think she celebrated her sexuality.
Right.
Built a fortune, built an empire.
Now, is that in the evolution of feminism? Was there a
yes.
time where that might have been like, no, you
oh,
that's.
If she did that during my generation.
She's objectifying. She'd make herself an object.
Yes.
Men are taking advantage,
yes.
blah, blah, blah. She couldn't be in control of her decision where it came to her sexuality.
That's right. That's what I
but
felt.
But she could allow them to take advantage in a way and use that and make
to
it.
To her benefit.
And think that she was taking advantage.
Well, in fact, she was.
But I think clearly she is.
She is. In full control
yeah.
of her artistry or whatever her, you know, whatever you call it. And I admire that. And if men want to treat her as less than, that's their problem.
Yeah.
I don't think she feels that way about herself at all.
What about Stormy Daniels?
Well, she's kind of my hero right now.
Right.
Love her.
I mean, Stormy kicks ass.
She kicks ass.
She's not fucking around with these people.
Uh-uh. And for someone who's been in that industry that is so disregarded and so shamed and so, you know, it's such a disrespected thing to do, porn, right? But here she is, fully empowered and taking on the president of the United States and taking on that... the deception and the lying and the corruption and the all that, that she's... I just find her really inspiring, actually.
Mm.
And how about the latest turn to learn only today that from Giuliani that Cohen was paid the money that he paid, the $130,000 that he paid to Stormy. He got paid back.
Trump paid him back. Which
President Trump?
President
paid him back.
That's
Trump
right.
paid the porn paid the guy who paid his porn star back.
But it had nothing to do with the election, right?
No, God, no. That's not
true. No, because it happened just like a week before. The
but
election.
Here's what else we've learned today is that Colin's phone was tapped.
Yes.
By the FBI. This is going to be very interesting.
Oh, that's going to be very interesting. But, you know, by the time this gets on the air, which could be as many as 5 days or 8 days, everything we're talking about is going to be such old news.
I know, right?
Exactly. Why don't we think of what possibly is going to happen and say it as if it's happening today, and we'll see who is right.
Okay.
I can't believe that Trump was impeached so quickly. It only took... What? Just 3 weeks. I really want to know. Back to the writing thing. What would you say to a male writer who is looking? What are you looking for as an actress when you find that script? I know that's a big answer, but if you can find it, what are you looking for? What are we talking about when we're talking about the multidimensional? The, you know.
Right. So I'm really attracted to. Obviously complex characters.
Yeah.
And one of the things I gravitate to is if you write as a male writer, if you write a flawed woman, that's really interesting.
Mm.
Not always likable, flawed, embracing the full imperfect humanity of the character. I still see in scripts, you know, not so much describing a woman of my age, but in the character description, she's beautiful. The light on her hair is light. You know, it's like, you don't have to do that. Like, we don't need to know. You can say she's, you know, attractive. Whatever.
They don't say that about dudes, right?
They
the
don't.
Light catches his hair.
No.
You know how he does. And all.
No, you don't. You don't get that. But, so I'm looking for, I always look for that kind of complexity. And, that's.
A realness, just a genuine...
Just a genuine realness, and imperfect and flawed and meaning well. but not necessarily strong all the time. That's boring.
Right.
I don't want to play a strong woman.
Right.
Christine, how old are your children?
My oldest is 29.
My oldest among the young ones is 29.
Yes, that's right. Didn't they go to school together?
Yes.
Wilson and your son is?
Benjamin,
yes.
Yeah.
And then, or they were a year apart, I guess. And then my twins are 24. And your twins?
My twins are 23.
23. Yeah. And they all went into, they were in the same theater group.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Adderley School, yeah, together.
Well, that's a good talent pool, right?
Ben Platt, hello.
Wow.
But you know who Ben Platt is. You're going to see the show, I think, aren't you? Going to see Evan Hansen?
Yes.
I don't think he's in it anymore.
He's not going to see that.
No, he's out. He's out. But the kid who's replaced him is supposed to be just, well, you have to be glorious to do that.
We're also going to see Springsteen on Broadway. Is Springsteen still in that?
No, I'm replacing him.
You his understudy.
Have you seen Springsteen?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Was that not a great night?
A great night. Now, that's what I mean. He just embraced every imperfection. He was so honest. You know, you think that I was this and this and this. Guess what? I wasn't. You know, I don't even know what I was writing about. I wasn't that guy, that whatever, that image that he was putting out. I just loved his humanity and how vulnerable and a sense of humor about himself.
That we embrace imperfection here. Do you have an imperfection, Norman?
I don't. You know, sadly, I don't.
I mean, I would tell you if I could find one. I mean, I'm too tall, I think, maybe, and too
that's
thin.
That's not an imperfection.
I think I'm too tall and thin.
I think
that's me. I am too, then.
Yeah, see, we're so imperfect. No, I'm kidding.
I think about this all the time, seeking, striving for an imperfection.
Let me know if you ever find one, Norman. I'm not seeing any right now. I don't see it.
Okay, so we are, you know, we have, you make me feel we haven't begun to cover.
I know.
This has been so fun. Thank you.
I just love this.
Heaven.
Love this. To be continued, my favorite expression in the English language.
To be continued.
I promise it'll grow on you.
True stories from an unreliable eyewitness, a feminist coming of age, the book by
in
Christine Lotte.
In your bookstore now?
Yes.
Thank you, Christine Lotte, for
book.
This glorious visit.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
Bye, all. That's been all of the above.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Ittman.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Welcome to the Dennis Miller Option. I mean, I remember Seagal came in some Alan Carr caftan or something, sat down with a Iroquois braid. I thought this is going to be a long week. Dana Carvey, ladies and gentlemen.
Why don't you yell out for Steve out there, see if you can get him to come in like you're the real deal.
Bulbous and Gordon, Arnold's stronger than you. Your buttocks are like marshmallows compared to Arnold's.
It was like the horse broke its leg in the back straight away, put the tent up and put me down. It was so awkward.
Remember to listen to new episodes of the Dennis Miller Option every Wednesday right here on Podcast One.
Do it.
You can follow Dennis on Twitter at DennisDMZ, Instagram at Dennis Miller, and on Facebook he's at Real Dennis Miller.
And by the way, I hide nothing here with the Dennis Miller podcast.
What kind of mind thinks of this?